It'll be first and 25.
This is First and 25, the Football Zebras podcast. This is our 25-minute roundtable discussion on officiating, our fifth episode, and we know that five will get you 10. I'm Ben Ostro, founder and editor-in-chief of Football Zebras. I'm joined by senior editor Mark Schultz, and writer and winner of the best microphone setup is Patrick Weber. That was a nomination that everybody was listening to the audio like, man, I wish I could sound like that. So let's start off. We have an interesting situation from Sunday near the end of the first half of the Packers-Vikings game where you had Matt LaFleur, Packers coach, running down the sideline to simultaneously call timeout and argue that the previous play was a touchdown. Referee Bill Vinovich, seeing LaFleur on the field, threw a flag for unsportsmanlike conduct. So I'll start with you, Mark, since you wrote the entry in the live blog on Sunday. Just give us a little bit of what you saw on that play.
I saw LaFleur running down. It appeared for a moment that he was unsure whether or not he wanted timeout. Then he called timeout. The officials didn't see him, and then he became more adamant that he wanted timeout. And then, I'm sorry, I'm sure he's a very nice guy, but that was a childish temper tantrum that he threw. He was jumping up and down, screaming at the officials, and whether or not the officials accidentally didn't see him or not, that can be corrected. But that type of behavior, while on the field, cannot be tolerated.
Yeah, I agree with that. And kind of just watching the replay, it almost seemed like as soon as the official looked away, that's when LaFleur signaled timeout. And that's kind of why it wasn't seen. And mechanically, you kind of expect the timeout situation to come, if they're going to call it, right at the end of the play. So you look over. And then as a short ring official at the goal line, you got a lot of stuff on your plate. So once it doesn't appear to be called a timeout, it's time to get into all the rest of your checklist, especially between plays with the clock running with under 30 seconds left.
So for those that are not well initiated on the field, kind of run, and it does change situationally, I get it. But you're in a goal-to-goal with a running clock under a minute to go. What's in that checklist?
Once the play's dead, we got to get our spot. We need to know where we're at as far as if we're inside the 7 or at the 7 to know who's going to have the goal line coverage and if we need to pop our deep wings back to the end line. We need to see substitutions for a count. In the NFL, under 2 minutes, they won't have substitution mechanics, but you still need to be aware of who's coming in and who's coming out and where they're going in and where they're going out. And then you got to get ready for your next play.
And when the prior play is over, usually the wing will glance up the sideline to the coach. And sometimes maybe even the referee will turn his head and look toward the sidelines to see if the coach wants timeout. And if he does, well, they'll grant it.
And so basically, it kind of goes to this, there's a rhythm of the game. And, you know, maybe even in different games, a rhythm is different because you mentioned the substitution mechanics, which are not in force inside the two-minute warning, which is if the offense substitutes, the defense gets a reasonable time to match up. And the question always is, well, what is a reasonable time? Can they just slow walk it? And if you are slow walking it on the defense, the referee is going to close out that substitution period. So the rule book kind of keeps that a little absent on what that is, but I think that the game dictate, well, the officials dictate the pace of the game outside of two. And I think that you kind of develop that rhythm as to, okay, this is what we're expecting on this substitution period.
Yeah, and you know, I don't know exactly how the NFL handles it, but I know at the college level, like, I'll tell the coaches in the pregame, you know, the one time you could leave the team box is to get our attention at the goal line to call timeout. But that means coming down the sideline to call timeout and not putting on the display that LaFleur did. And I think if he just gets their attention and calls timeout without the extra theatrics, they grant him the timeout, and they just move on. And I know we talked the last few weeks about behavior on the field and when it's appropriate to talk to the officials. I mean, if they wait 25 seconds to get into halftime, LaFleur has a chance to maybe air it out a little bit in a more appropriate setting and in a more appropriate way that he wasn't happy that his timeout wasn't seen. And they can have an actual discussion about that.
And Pat, in the college game, if a coach calls timeout and maybe the official didn't see it, he called timeout at 20 seconds, and you hear the coach yell timeout, and you look up the sideline to the coach and you say, "You want time?" And he yells timeout, and then you blow it dead. He asked for time at 20. You granted him time at 18. Can you reset the clock to 20 seconds?
We can. And if we knew that he was asking, we were confirming, and it was at 20, we can put it back.
And then you have a situation in the NFL, as far as where you have a replay involved. They will only go off of not the coach's signal, but an official's signal. So there might be a recognition that you see that, but then the only way replay can get involved in it is when they see a definitive signal. And that's usually going to be when the clock is really, although they can do that as kind of an administrative correction, right, coming into the timeout. But it's a margin of a few seconds. Yes, they're valuable, but again, you go back to having that discussion with the coach beforehand, saying, come down the sideline and call timeout, and clearly call timeout, because we did see a mix of signals from Matt LaFleur, which were timeout and flailing his arms in frustration. Part of it might be that he felt that he should have gotten a couple of seconds earlier on the timeout. And again, you say the referee might even be looking over there. But his attention was to the center of the field. It wasn't to the line judge at that particular time. Yes, if you want to dispute the previous play, okay, you had the timeout, and it's your quarter to spend there and discuss it with the, you know, you're probably not going to get anywhere because they've already reviewed it quickly upstairs. But you call the timeout first, then you argue. And it was kind of this exasperation, which I get it. It's part of the game, and you know, the things get a little intense. And so there is some leeway, but you know, if you're trying to get the line judge's attention, yeah, you might step out a little bit onto the field and just to get the angle so you can be seen. But that's like a step or two. If you're out halfway to the numbers, I don't know as there's been a situation where that has not been a flag. Other than in an injury period, coach has to stay on the white. If you step on the green, you see yellow.
It's as simple as that. And I understand that football is an emotional game, and LaFleur's emotions and his tension was running high. He was at maximum stress at that point. But the bottom line is he lost control of his emotions and he lost 15 yards.
And let me just kind of jump in. We've talked about Bill Vinovich in the past, about his game management. He gets a lot of assignments to some really big divisional matchups. This one, you know, an NFC Central classic, as I like to say. So an NFC North battle early in the season. You know, he'll do AFC North as well. And those particular games are just absolutely heightened. And he seems to be one of the best at, if not the best, at getting control of those situations where they can quickly get out of hand.
I think he's one of the best at he lays down where the line is, and if it gets crossed, it will be penalized. I don't remember the year, but I believe it was a Ravens Steelers game a few years ago that was kind of getting chippy, and I believe he had a conversation with both coaches at a break that he basically said, "It's time to play football. We've had enough, and if it continues, we're going to flag it."
Vinovich draws a line, as Pat said, and then he strictly enforces it. But what impresses me is he enforces it with a sense of calmness. He does not start barking at the players and barking at the coaches, and you don't see this exasperated face making an announcement, and you don't hear an exasperated voice barking out the penalty announcement. He says, "All right, I drew the line, you crossed it, the flag is down, and here's what's going to happen." He opens his mic and he says it. He's one of the best.
And particularly when you put an unsportsmanlike conduct flag down like that, there's no putting the toothpaste back in the tube. You've got to call it at that point. No matter how much sweet talking that comes, "Oh, I didn't mean it. Oh, I was trying to this or that." There just really isn't a way to back out of that. And it still comes back to the fact that without the flag, the headline is that LaFleur really chewed out the refs there and nothing happened. And if that's going to be the headline, that has to be reversed with a penalty. There cannot be that impression that one side got a leg up on the official, got one over on an official. And, you know, it just gives that impression that just has to be nipped in the bud. And like you said, there's a clear, bright line that gets crossed there. And most coaches stay under it. And then, you know, even good coaches sometimes stray over that line, and then we have a foul on the bench. So again, I think it was, you know, as unfortunate as it was you know, for the Packers to have been penalized. They did score on the next play, so that it kind of made it a moot point. But at least it's something that is on tape for everybody, for all the teams. Like, this is where we draw the line, and we're going to enforce it. One more thing on Vinovich is there was the timeout, and so he did give Matt LaFleur this opportunity to kind of reset, because it's not fair to have a coach all wound up and, you know, and whether or not he thinks that it's the official's fault or not, whatever the situation, he allows them unwind and get that out in a reasonable manner, in a very frank discussion. You saw him talking to him on the sideline, really trying to talk it down into a reset situation. It's not something you see in the rule book. It's something you learn over time, and good officials at all levels pick up on that stuff.
Especially with someone like Bill Vinovich, who has his basketball schedule, a lot of time to practice, especially in that sport.
That is something, that's a skill that, all right, maybe the wing officials get that to some extent, but man, you are just so close to not only the bench, but, you know, the crowd, and yeah, you hear everything. And man, that's got to be the thickest skin of all the sports to officiate basketball. So let's take a switch over to a couple of plays we saw over the weekend involving the pylon, where we had a close call at the pylon, and one of them you had, Mark, so I'll kind of start off with you on this. And basically, you see a sweep coming to the outside in a goal-to-go situation, and you're the wing official there. So put us in that wing's shoes for a moment, other than the sheer panic that's coming over them at that moment.
They say that officiating is 58 minutes of boredom and 2 minutes of sheer terror. That's about 7 seconds of the 2 minutes of sheer terror. Normally on a sweep, an official slide steps into the backfield and lets the sweep pass him or her by. But on the goal line, they have to stand in there and they have to straddle that goal line. What they do is they back up. They go back, they go back, they go back. And on the play we were talking about, Walter Flowers, the line judge, backed up to the dotted restraining line, and he kept going backwards. He was almost at the TV camera crane when the dive at the pylon happened. He needed to get wide for two reasons. One, so he could see the knee of the runner down or not, and then where the ball was. Did it break the plane? And secondly, and Pat, if you're a wing official in college, you know too, when they're diving at the pylon, you can't be straddling that pylon or you will be retired quickly.
Yeah, I am on my college crew. I am the head line judge, so I am very familiar with the short wing. And when it's my goal line responsibility, I actually will start with my toes on the back of the on the outside back of the white, because I can move to a straight line and be wide and not really have to back up as much. And I have that play in front of me, and I don't have to worry about my knees getting taken out while I stand in there to see where the ball is. Getting a goal, I mean, there is, like you said, 7 seconds of terror, but getting a good goal line pylon play is a fun play to get, and they don't really all, I mean, the NFL, you get them more, but I maybe see one or two good ones a season. And if you can nail those calls, it looks real good.
And that's one of the things, you watch it at home, and you're like, oh my gosh, what are they going to call here? And, you know, when it's that close, and, but again, we're on TV, we're a little further back, have a little bit more of a wider view, but, you know, being that close to it, you know, you've got that angle. And
even if you're safe, you think you're safe at the pylon, you still need to back up to get that panoramic view, because the ball carrier and the ball come crashing right at the line, and you don't know where the knee is. You need to be wide to see the knee, the out of bounds, and the...
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, you need to be far enough back so you can see essentially two places at once in your one single snapshot. You got to see the knee and the ball. And, you know, one thing I'll mention too, on the fields I work on, I can get kind of as deep as I want without having to worry about a camera crew and all the millions of people that are on an NFL sideline that those guys have to worry about with their, when they step, take a few steps off the sideline. And it gets really crowded real fast.
Yeah, one of the things that we noticed, you know, you usually were constrained to, you had the six-foot white border, and then there was a dashed constraining line behind that. I think that's another 6 feet back. So that pretty much was the, you know, this is the working area. And 2020 happened, and, you know, we had a whole different world, and we had sidelines that were not occupied anymore during the pandemic. And so the officiating instruction, at least in the NFL, and I think it did bleed down to some of the other levels, was you have this space, use it. Go all the way back near to the wall if you have to get that view of the play. Also to be out of the way of, you know, these players that are crashing in out of control. So, you know, that's one of the things that did hang on after the pandemic. They left the lines where they were, but I know that there was additional instruction to those that were doing media on the sideline. You have to give a wider berth there specifically around the goal line. You can't just sit there and watch. I saw an old NFL Films video from the 70s, 50s actually, and there were folding chairs with disabled veterans right near the goal line there, about 10 feet in. So it was like, it was not only was there spectators, but they weren't very mobile spectators as well, right at that crash point there.
There's also a footage in the 70s or late 60s, a player broke free down the sideline, right on the sideline. Tony Viteri was the head linesman chasing him down. There were photographers and general hangers-on with their toes right on the sideline. Viteri had to actually dart into the field of play and kind of go around them. Boy, I'm glad they have that restraining line now.
Yeah, they probably need to have a couple of ropes up or something as they get, particularly when they get to the playoffs, where you have more media there. In the north, you sometimes have big piles of snow also on the sideline, so that's taking up a fair amount of real estate out there. And that's one of the things that, particularly at the NFL level, there is just so many staff members that work there in the football operations area. So in addition to security, you have people that are still working in there to try and keep things freed up. But, you know, we've seen some video where there's been some nasty collisions in the beyond the end line or in a corner of the end zone between a photographer and the players, and so they're kind of trying to keep that a little bit wider, and additionally they've put more restrictions on who can be on the sideline there. I just kind of want to also touch on, we were talking about calling plays at the pylon, and there's a couple other situations that do come up with the minute that we have left here. Basically, you have two different situations as a dive to the pylon, because you can't have a player that just starts a dive at the 5-yard line and goes towards the sideline and uses the goal line extended way out of bounds. So they do have to originate and keep the ball in bounds, at least go over the pylon or into or inside of the pylon. So in those situations, you know, when you have a dive that's coming to the pylon, you know, that they do have to keep that ball at least nicking a corner of that goal. And then if the runner is able to put a foot in the end zone, then all of those restrictions are out. Then they can actually use the goal line extended, so they could have a foot down in the end zone, and now that ball does cross the goal line extended. But we have Michael Vick to thank for some of those really tight calls on where the ball needs to be when it crosses the goal line. I mean, have you seen anything like that where you've had like a real tight dive at that pylon and you're like, you know, what do we got here?
Yeah, I've had a couple of plays over the years. Actually, Steve Shaw on his video last week talked about goal line extended, so it's a hot topic. I think I've had maybe one or two though where the ball hit the pylon or had a real good stretch. So I mean, I don't see it a lot. So sometimes those plays can be pretty crazy.
I've never had one, and I'm glad I haven't. Those are tight, tough calls.
And with that, that wraps up another episode of the First and 25 podcast. Thanks to Mark Schultz and Pat Weber. I'm Ben Ostro. We'll be dropping a new episode every Tuesday throughout the season. Please spread the word. If you're listening on the Football Zebras website, you can also find us on your preferred podcasting app. And please subscribe. Many thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.